The following presentation is brought to you by Better Together, building better marriages and stronger families.
Tell you one thing, we're better together.
I want to introduce to you our speaker for today is Marcus Warner. Marcus is the president of Deeper Walk International. Marcus has served as a professor at a Bible college. He has also been a pastor and has just a lot of insight and interesting ideas on this topic that I know that you're going to enjoy. Please welcome Marcus Warner.
All right. Thank you, Derek. All right. Let you know, I'm not a professional counselor, but as he mentioned, I've been a Bible professor. I've been a pastor. And when you get into ministry, you find yourself counseling. That's just no way around it. And so for 25 years or more, I've been meeting with people along the way. A little bit more background. My father was the president of Fort Wayne Bible College for a while. He taught at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in the Deerfield, Illinois area, and was on staff with Neil Anderson Freedom in Christ Ministries. So I grew up around a lot of Christian higher education, grew up around a lot of this background. In our ministry, started out actually as a spiritual warfare focused ministry, and that was helping people with the spiritual battles they were fighting, identifying what the root causes of those were and overcoming them. Began to realize that when people come to you with spiritual warfare issues, they have other baggage too. And so very quickly began to learn that, you know, you need to help holistically with a person, understanding what all of these issues are that they're bringing to the table, what some of the core root issues really are. And so I appreciate what he's talking about, getting below the surface and finding out what's going on underneath is so critical in marriages. Because what I found is that most marriages begin with a cracked foundation. And most of the problems that married couples run into, they already had those problems when they got married. They weren't created because of the marriage. There were deficiencies in their own personal growth that they brought into the marriage that caused problems. For example, I have a friend who met on his wedding day. Right? He's from a foreign country, and they met on their wedding day. 25 years later, 4 kids later, they've got a great marriage. You know, they've raised things right. How can that happen, right? Where some couple meets on their wedding day, ends up having, you know, a wonderful marriage. And yet, all over America, we've got people who are desperately in love with each other, who aren't sure if they want to get married, so they move in together first, and then eventually decide, you know, well, now that we're having kids, why don't we go ahead and make this official? And it's a problem that's part of our culture, and the marriages don't work. Well, my theory on it is basically this, and that is that when you put two relatively mature people together, they can kind of figure it out. When you put two relatively immature people together, they're almost dead before they start. In fact, I would suggest to you that the number one problem in marriage today is immaturity. In fact, you can put it in statistical form. Heard it said that 75% of males in America function at infant level maturity. Now, what that means is that to function at infant level maturity means I'm in a grown-up body, but emotionally, personally, I function like an infant. Now, you stop and think about it. When an infant wants something, can they tell you, you know, it would really appreciate it if you would change my diaper? Can't do that, can they? So one of the characteristics of infant level maturity is that you don't know how to ask for what you need. You just sort of assume that people are going to take care of you. And so your job is to let people know you're upset. I'm just not happy about this. It's the other person's job to figure out why you're upset, you know, decipher the signals you're doing and make things okay. And if they don't do that well, they are the problem. That's basically infant level maturity. And according to the source I had, 75% of males live there. 75% of females live at child level maturity. So child level maturity basically means that I can tell you what I need. I have to go potty. I would like to eat. You know, I want a nap. Well, what happens is that when you put a child-level woman and an infant-level man together, you have which is, again, the majority of marriages in America, what you have is a recipe for disaster, don't you?
because you've got a guy who just wants to have fun and just wants everything to be easy. And you've got a lady who wants, you know, just to be taken care of, and she wants somebody to show some responsibility and respect. So in a typical marriage counseling setting, what you run into is a guy who wants to know when she stopped, you know, having fun, and why marriage can't be fun like it used to be, and when it, you know, why does she make everything so hard? And you've got a lady who wants to know when he's going to grow up and start taking some responsibility around the house. And so he's like, all she does is nag. Why? Because all she's doing all day long is telling him what she wants. I want this, I want this, I need you to do this, I need you to do that. Well, to him, that's nagging, right? And meanwhile, she's like, he won't communicate. You know, he never tells me what he wants. So, you know, he won't just, why can't he just communicate his needs? Well, part of the reason is that they've just never learned the skills. And the reason they've never learned those skills is that their parents didn't have the skills to pass down to them. Their grandparents probably didn't have the skills to pass down to them. And this thing becomes generational then. It just cycles on through. So let me give you four characteristics of what maturity looks like. If you're going to function at adult level maturity, these are four characteristics you should have. You can think of them as skills that everybody needs to learn. Characteristic number one is that you're able to remain relational. You're able to remain relational when under stress. Now, you stop and think about it. What we're talking about here, all these things have in common is a capacity to live with joy. That if I have enough joy, capacity for joy in my life, I can handle a lot more stress than if I don't. You can think of it this way. If I've got a container from here to here, if I've only got this much joy in it, then that's all the more stress I can handle in life. And that also is going to define my level of maturity. So that means I can handle about this much, and if my stress level goes above here, then what happens is I stop acting like an adult and I revert back to, you know, very immature behavior. The more joy that I have, the more capacity for joy that I have, the more that I can handle. One very practical ramification of this is if you're going to have a hard conversation in marriage, for example, you're going to sit down with somebody, you're going to talk about our debt, okay? Not an easy, fun conversation. It's a good idea to do something to build joy first before you have that conversation. So, for example, a friend of mine would say to his wife, you know, honey, we're going to have a conversation that historically has been kind of triggering for us and difficult. What do you say we go snuggle on the couch first? And just have a little time together, have some eye contact, you know, let you know I love you, hold hands, and then we can kind of start into our conversation. And if the conversation gets too stressful, we'll take a break from it, we'll come back, we'll snuggle a little more, we'll hold hands a little more, then we'll come back to the conversation. Because what happens is that most people, when you have a stressful conversation, you lose the capacity to remain relational. And one of two things happens when you lose your capacity for relationship. You either shut down or you blow up. It's kind of like an outlet, you know, stick something into an electrical outlet. If you call for too much current from that electrical outlet, what happens? Right? Best case scenario, you trip the circuits and it shuts down, but things could blow up and set on fire. It's the same thing. When I'm in a conversation or situation that is calling for more maturity out of me than I have the capacity to give, those are the responses that tend to happen. I either shut down or I blow up. And so adult capacity is characterized by an ability to remain relational through this conversation, to remain relational through the stressful thing and continue, you know, if I get overwhelmed, to recognize I'm being overwhelmed and go back and rebuild some joy. But finding a way to get through this thing and still have a relationship intact by the time we're done. Make sense? All right. Number two, I want to act like myself. I want to act like myself. Now, not everybody associates the words acting like yourself with being mature. Because we know a lot of people who are really immature, and they'll justify it by saying, well, I'm just being me. You know, of course I, you know, got myself all tatted up and have, you know, all the, you know, something in my tongue and everything else, but I just got to be me. Well, I would suggest to you that they're doing that because they have no idea who they are. Right? They aren't just being them. They don't know what it is to act like themselves. And so what we find is that adults, when you are interacting with an adult, you get the same person in every setting you meet them. So if you meet somebody at work in the workplace, you get the same adult. You meet them at home, you get the same adult. You meet them under stress, you get the same adult. You meet them when they're out there competing on the basketball court, same adult. When they're out driving, you get the same adult, okay? What happens to people with low emotional capacity is that when they get triggered, they stop being adults and they jump back down to their maturity age, either infancy or childhood. And then what you end up with is an infant or a child on your hands who isn't acting like themselves. So first one is they remain relational. Second one is they act like themselves. Third characteristic is they return to joy quickly. According to brain science research, it is possible to return to joy from any negative emotion in 2 minutes. Now, some of us live there our whole lives, so the idea that it is actually possible to return from something like hopeless despair in 2 minutes doesn't even, sounds like what world are you living in? But the reason that people don't have these return to joy skills largely is that they weren't developed. And they weren't developed growing up because they weren't trained in them. And so you can think of it this way. From a brain science perspective, negative emotions are like in the back of your head, and joy and acting like yourself is in the front of your head. So when I'm acting like myself, if you want to know who you really are is who you are when you're living with joy. Now that gets robbed from us when I go back here to these negative emotions like shame and anger and despair and anxiety and whatever. These negative emotions back here, one of the skills that every child is supposed to learn is how to have that emotion and get back to joy from it. So, for example, if a child gets angry, one of the jobs of a parent is to validate that child's anger, saying, "Wow, you are really mad right now, aren't you?" "Yeah, I'm so mad." Invalidate the anger and then comfort them. In the process of validating and comfort them, you help them return back to joy. And if you do that often enough, they can have this experience of anger, and there is a built-in pathway now in their brain that can get them back to joy relatively quickly because they've had help doing this over and over and over again. But what happens if the child feels anger, it expresses anger, but the parent is like infant or child level emotional capacity and can't handle anger, and so gives anger back at the child? Well, now the child not only does not have a pathway of how do I get back to joy from this emotion, now they're stuck in that emotion. It's a scary emotion. Now they're going to have more things. They're going to have fear wrapping around that emotion. They're going to have shame wrapping around that emotion because what's wrong with me that I can't, do this right? And so part of this whole parenting strategy here is how parents have to be consistent about learning how to validate and comfort emotions. So let me get real quickly, just tell you what I mean by validate and comfort. Validate basically means to define the emotion and give it a numerical value. So you help a child say, what you're feeling right now is shame. Shame, does that sound right that you're feeling shame? What's shame? You describe it to them. Yeah, that's what I'm feeling. Scale of 1 to 10, that sounds like you're way up there, like 8, 9, 10. That's a really big feeling you're having. And what you're doing is you're validating the fact they're having the emotion. What you're not doing is validating that it's legitimate to be having that emotion right now. You don't have to legitimate their interpretation of reality to validate the fact that, yes, you are having a really big emotion, and this is what that emotion is. But once you do that, comforting is essentially making it smaller, and that's by saying things like, well, you know what? You're not going to die. Well, that's good news. You're not going to die. You're going to feel better here pretty soon. Here, let me help you. And you just do various things that take that big, enormous emotion and start shrinking it. And as you go through that process, eventually something triggers, they get back to acting like themselves. And when they get back to acting like themselves, they're acting with joy again. Well, it's the same thing in our adult marriage relationships, too. We get triggered sometimes, and when we get triggered, we stop acting like ourselves, and we stop living with joy, and we stop being relational with people, and we get stuck. Well, adults learn the capacity to return to joy from those upset emotions and not let them control themselves in those interactions that they're having. So we got three. Remain relational, act like yourself, return to joy. The last one is endure trials. And basically what this means is adults endure hard things without losing these first three characteristics. I can endure a lot before I stop being relational. I can endure a lot before I stop acting like myself. I can endure a lot before I can't return to joy from it.
So if you spell those out, you get the word rare, R-A-R-E. Remain relational, act like yourself, return to joy, endure trials. Helps me remember, because these are unfortunately very rare skills, because we don't have a lot of people living with adult level maturity. All right, now, the reason people don't develop these maturity skills largely is two reasons. We call it A trauma and B trauma. Some of you may be familiar with the terminology. A trauma is the absence of good stuff that you need. B trauma is bad stuff that happens to you. So, using the brain analogy, A trauma means nobody ever told me how to get from anger to joy. Since nobody ever helped me get from anger to joy, that pathway simply never developed. It's not in my brain. So if nobody has ever been taught how to go from anger to joy, you can't sit there in a conversation and say, snap out of it. You know, come on, pull yourself together. You need to start functioning with joy. They can't do it because they never developed the skill. Their brain just can't go there. So what's going to happen is there's going to have to be steps developed, and they're, as an adult now, going to have to begin developing this pathway of getting from here to here, because there was an absence. Right? They missed out on something good. Another way to think of this is like with plants. If you are going to grow, you know, it's spring, we're going to plant gardens, that sort of thing. If you're going to plant a garden, and what would be some effective ways to kill the plants that you put the seeds in the ground? Yeah, don't water it. What would be another effective way to kill the plants?
Overwater
them, okay?
No sun.
Right? Bad sun. Now, when I ask this question, you notice that most things people tell you off the way about how to kill a plant is by what you don't do to it. It's the same thing with human beings. Children are traumatized by what doesn't happen to them. They are traumatized by the fact that nobody showed them how to get from anger to joy. Nobody showed them how to get from shame to joy. Nobody showed them how to get from, you know, anxiety to joy. As a result, when they have these feelings, they're stuck back there, and they live out of them as if that's normal. And so there is a capacity that is not built, and the reason that isn't built is because they have been traumatized by what didn't happen. Just like a plant can be traumatized by what you don't do to it. The second way that this gets interfered with is B trauma, and B trauma is the bad stuff that happens to us. So bad stuff would be like, well, my parents taught me how to go from anger to joy, but when I was 12 years old, I had this really bad thing happen to me. You know, somebody, you know, beat me up in the playground or something like that, and now I've got this trauma, and every time that I start to go back to joy from this, I run into that roadblock because I've got this B trauma thing that's happened there. Well, they have different results because of this. If someone has A trauma, if someone has B trauma, I guarantee they have A trauma also. And some people who have a pretty good foundation in the parenting that they received and the other skills that they learned will still have abusive things that have happened to them in their life that have, you know, kind of put the kibosh on their capacity to live out of that in the present. So that's what we want to talk about here, in a sense, is most of what undermines marital things tends to have to do with this idea of capacity, that people did not develop the skill capacity they needed. What I want to focus on right now is on this B trauma idea and the bad stuff that happens to people and what unpacks there. Now, if you saw the promo video of what I was going to talk about, I showed a little thing here called Wounds, Lies, Vows, and Strongholds. I can refer to it as WLVS, like a radio station. WLVS, W is wounds, L is lies, V is vows, S is strongholds. And the idea of a stronghold is that there's an area of my life where I am not free to act like myself. When I get in that area, I'm stuck. You know, I want to live with freedom, I want to live with maturity, but I just can't. I'm stuck for some reason. The V stands for vow. The vow is an I will statement that I make, saying, I will never feel this emotion again, or I will never let anybody treat me like that again, or I will prove to everybody that I'm better than they say that I am. And these internal vows that we make give shape to our lives, but they grow out of the L, which is lies, that got planted in our heart because of wounds. So let me go through it forward here. And you can try this because it's kind of fun. All right. Just put your fists together and say, once we go through life,
sooner or later, our hearts get wounded. When our hearts get wounded, from a, you know, a Bible perspective, there's two farmers out there with bags of seeds waiting to put seeds in that wounded place. Farmer one's the Holy Spirit. He wants to put seeds of truth in there. If his seeds of truth go in there and I believe it, I close up over that, and that seed takes root as I believe it. And now that that seed takes root, I start making decisions as if, you know what, God does love me, I can trust him, there is a future, there is a hope, those sorts of things. And now a vine grows up out of that seed, which are the decisions I'm making, the vows that I'm making, as if that's true. And then fruit grows up on that vine and produces, you know, wonderful character qualities in my life. But there is another farmer, isn't there? So what happens if my heart breaks, but instead of the Holy Spirit's true seeds, I hear the devil's, who's called the father of lies in the Bible, he succeeds in planting a lie in that wounded place in my heart, and I believe that lie. And I go, oh man, that's true. And I say to myself, now that's the truth. You know, I'm a loser. I'm horrible. I'm no good. Nobody could ever love me. As soon as I embrace that as truth, now that takes root. And now I start making decisions as if that's the truth. And now that grows into a vine, which gives shape to my life as I make vows, you know, about what I will and will not do. Give you an example. You know, one of the objectives of Better Together is that we want to help improve marriages because of the needs of children. So I'll give you an example. I was preaching about this at a church up near Fort Wayne not too long ago, and talking about, you know, what do we do about this? How do we fix it? And again, giving very, very Christian, very spiritual answers and solutions to these things in the sermon. And there was an eighth grade girl who emailed me later and said, as you were talking, I prayed. I said, Lord, would you show me, are there any wounds in my past that are affecting the way I live today? Are there any lies that Satan planted in there that I should know about? She said, I went home and I prayed that prayer, Lord, would you show me? And she reminded me, when I was 6 years old, my parents got divorced. And so I prayed. I said, Lord, would you show me, did Satan succeed in planting any lies in my heart from that wounding experience? And the first thought that came into her head when she prayed that was, it was your fault. It was your fault. So now she's 13 years old. You know, she's in eighth grade. You know, she's trying out for cheerleading. She's doing all this stuff in her school. And do you think that having buried down in a wounded place in your heart this idea that it was your fault your parents got divorced would have any effect on your relationships? Can you imagine the type of vows you might make out of something like that? Well, I better not let anybody get too close to me because I ruin relationships. Right? Or I better not, you know, do this, or I better not do that. And now what's happened is she's making vows about how she's going to live her life as if that's the truth. So she went through there. It was very, you know, healing for her just to see that. But she went on further, and she began to actually pray a resistance prayer, saying, in the name of Jesus, I renounce the lie that it was my fault my parents got married. And she actually found herself in a spiritual battle for about a half an hour till she got to the other side of this thing and finally got a victory and a breakthrough, because it wasn't just an idea. It was planted there by a spiritual enemy. And she had to do some battle with that spiritual enemy before she was finally free. So she's sending me an email to let me know about this and how she spent a half an hour crying and till she finally broke, you know, got that breakthrough that she needed, and it didn't feel true anymore. And I saw her a week later, and she seemed to still be doing well. I haven't been able to follow up, but it's just an example. I could probably give you hundreds of examples of this, of how this works out in people's lives. Well, when folks get married, guess what? They're bringing a lot of baggage with them into the marriage. And a lot of the baggage that they're bringing with them in the marriage goes back to this wound, lie, vow pattern that's been established that has created problems for them. And so what happens is you have these triggers that go on. So I look at it this way. It's kind of like on my outside, I've got buttons all over me. And every one of these buttons has a wire going to it inside my body down to a big powder keg down in my belly. And this powder keg down in my belly, guess what's inside of it? Wounds, lies, vows, and strongholds. So inside of this powder keg are these wounds, lies, vows, and strongholds, and there's a wire coming up from this to these buttons. So what happens is I can come into a place like this, and as long as I'm not triggered, you might not know I have any issues. And as long as I'm in certain scenarios and certain parts of my life, I'm not getting triggered, and it's easy for me to live like, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. In fact, I can remember when I was in college, I didn't really like psych majors. Because from my perspective, you know, the only people I knew in psychology department were people trying to figure out why they were so messed up. And I thought, you know, I'd never seen an emotionally healthy person who was a psych major. So, and meanwhile, I figured I was pretty well adjusted and had, you know, things together. After all, I was an athlete. So, the, you know, our life is about confidence. So I married a psych major. And it was kind of interesting because, I mean, honestly, when we started our marriage, it was sort of like, I know she's got issues, but, you know, we'll be okay because I don't. You know, and it was like, and as we, we got to a certain point about 13 years into our marriage where we were having one of those fights. We were out Christmas shopping. Things were just falling apart fast. And it started when I was walking a couple paces ahead of her in the store, and she reached out her hand and put it on my shoulder and kind of pivoted me, like, you will talk to me. And I didn't realize it, but I had made a vow a long time ago that no woman was ever going to control me. Without even thinking, without having anything, I had this an instinctive rage response when she put her hand on her shoulder and just pivoted me. Now, to fill out the rest of the picture, I was a pastor at this point. It was Saturday night. I was supposed to get up the next morning and tell people how to be spiritual. So here you are. So we go back to the car so we don't have a fight in the middle of the store. You know, we're sitting as far away from each other as we can sit. And as we're going here, I have this thought come into my mind. It starts Marcus, which makes me think maybe this is the Holy Spirit. Because I don't usually dress myself that way. I call myself Dr. Warner. So then this voice comes in. It says, Marcus. It says, I'm like, what? and it was just like, you know, you've been married for 13 years, and you have to admit, it's not her issues that are undermining this marriage, it's yours. And it was like this lightning bolt hit me. It was this aha moment. It's like, uh-oh, I have issues. Because what had happened was my issues were really nicely tucked away down in this powder keg, and they only got triggered when she would push buttons. So it was really easy for me to rationalize, it's her fault. This only happens when she's around. Right? This only happens to me when she's, you know, engaging with me. And so I've spent my whole marriage blaming her for our problems. In reality, all she was doing was pushing buttons that were igniting something that was going on inside of me. So I explained this to a teenage boy one time. I said, does this illustration of buttons and powder kegs make sense to you? He said, yeah. I said, well, what do you think we ought to do about it? Yes, I'll just make sure nobody ever pushes my buttons. Well, that is a vow. I will be sure no one ever pushes my buttons. And guess what? He had become the class clown. You know, he had developed all of these patterns in his life to keep people at an arm's distance because he didn't want anybody pushing buttons that were going to cause anything to explode. And that is the number one response to this, is that we become avoidant people. We just avoid hard people, hard conversations, hard things, because when we get into those hard areas, that's when our buttons tend to get pushed, and things happen that I don't like. And it's easier just to avoid the whole mess. So as I was talking to this young man, I said, don't you think it might be a better idea to defuse the bomb inside? He said, well, how do we do that? Well, to defuse the bomb inside, we got to go back to what are the wound? What was the original wound? What were the original lies that got planted in that wounded area? How do I uproot those lies and get the truth in there instead? Got to renounce these vows. So, and all this is kind of underneath work that I got to get done. That if I don't do this, all of my well-intentioned efforts to change my behavior are going to be sabotaged before I begin, aren't they? And this is why, you know, we look at this on a level like this. It says, here's the presenting issue, here's another issue, and then we got the hidden issues down here. And the reason that so many people are trying really hard to change their behavior up here can't do it is that they are trapped down here by these strongholds in their lives that have been developed by the wounds, the lies, the vows in their experience. How we fix this, basically, is through prayer, interactive prayer. And that is, you talk to God about it. You say, God, would you bring to my mind right now any wound that is giving Satan, you know, that gave Satan permission to put a lie in my heart? And you interactive with God in prayer. Sometimes it's a good idea to do this with another person who can kind of walk through that process with you. And then you ask God, would you show me specifically what those lies were that got planted in there? And then you say, Jesus, would you come in here and would you show me what the truth is? Do whatever you need to do, Jesus, to uproot that lie and show me what the truth is. And as people go through this interactive prayer process, I've seen hundreds of people find freedom from things they never thought they could ever be free from. Now, I got a book over here called Real Prayer. And real prayer doesn't mean that other kinds of prayer are wrong. It's an acrostic, okay? It's a four-step pattern. That's R-E-A-L. And R is remember the wound. E, explore the lies and the beliefs. A, ask Jesus to come in. And the L, look and listen to see what he does. And so it's meant to be a design prayer pattern for people to go through. We've got another book called Whatever Believers Should Know About Spiritual Warfare. Because sometimes when you get in this, you find yourself up against the enemy who planted the lie there in the first place. And you might need to know a few things about that. But the core book I've got is called Spirit-Filled Home. And everything I've talked about today is in that book at some level or another. So it's the big picture of what's going on and how all these different pieces fit together. Obviously, we have 35 hours of training, and I've got a half an hour today. So that's all I can share for today. let me just open up, see if there's any questions that you have at this point. Yes?
What do you mean 35 hours of training?
Deeper Walk International, which is the ministry I lead, we have an institute that trains with three classes in it. And so we have a basic institute that lays the foundation for all this stuff. And then we have a class just on marriage and family that takes the foundational things and applies it to that. And then we have an advanced issues one where we talk about things like, you know, as advanced as dissociation and borderline and some of the really difficult things people run into.
How difficult is it to find out what the problem is?
Well, it just depends. It mostly depends on how honest the person's willing to be. If you get somebody who wants help and who is willing to be honest, it's relatively easy to figure out what the problem is. Most of the time, it's just a matter of praying and asking. I found God to be very faithful to bring things to mind. The problem is that if you're not doing it intentionally, a lot of things, the things that come to mind are coming to mind already, but you just never put two and two together that that's what the issue is that you need to address.
If a person's not spiritual, then how?
A person's not spiritual, you got to, you can still go through this process with them, but it only works if God shows up and actually brings something to their mind. So I look at this as Jesus who healed people even before they were necessarily followers of his. Jesus can still do things for that. But like I said, part of this premise is that this only works because God is actually showing up and doing something.
So if they don't recognize God, it has to be intercessory through you.
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, people can still pray to God who don't know them. But they just have different, you know, there's a differences in what they can expect. But if somebody's going to God in honest prayer, asking for help, you know, God will interact with that person.
How would you define a stronghold?
Stronghold is an area where I'm stuck because of a lie that I'm believing or a web of lies that I'm believing. And so for me personally, I believe that when you have a stronghold in an area of stuckness, you always have a spiritual warfare issue in your hands as well.
So on the A, trauma is in the absence of good, is always an absence of being comforted and
now, the question is, with A, trauma, is it always an absence of nurturing, essentially, of being comforted and soothed? No, those are just the illustrations I gave. Any kind of training that you miss out on. For example, there's not a piano in here, but if there was a piano in here, my sister and I were both present, my sister could go down and essentially play anything. All right? I can sit there, you know, and play Sesame Street. And that's it. I'm not very versatile. And the reason is, I had like 3 years of piano lessons in very early elementary school and quit. So my lack of training now means I have a lack of capacity with the piano. You can take this in almost any area of life. Camping, gardening, artwork, music, athletics. The training you don't get limits you. And that very limitation causes you to not be free in that area of your life. And so In a classic scenario, you've got a wife who came from a really angry, volatile family where they everybody's talking over each other all the time. There's animated, but they're really good at getting back to joy from anger because they do it every day, all the time. And they marry, the Norwegian, who is like their family, anger wasn't allowed in the family. They have no idea what to do with it. And so they're traumatized every time the wife gets angry and she doesn't think anything about it. Okay. Well, he didn't get the same skill training she got of how do you do this. And so because that skill is missing, that capacity is missing, that would correspond to the skill. There is a group called, if you go to lifemodel.org, lifemodel.org, they list 19 brain skills that are rooted in brain science research that to be a fully trained brain functioning at an adult level, you need to have all 19 of these skills. And they do a really good job of identifying it. And some of those have to do with comforting, but a lot of them have to do with other things at all. The other thing that's interesting is they're all relational. Because joy, we talked about joy being the key thing, capacity, is a relational word. I experience joy when I experience that somebody's happy to be with me. If you've got a mother who is just overwhelmed by life, and she's got a little infant and preschool kids at home, but she's just so preoccupied with her own issues that she loves those babies and little ones to death because of what they give to her and how they feed her. But as a result, she's not always there when they need her. She's there for them when she needs them. And you get a reverse parenting thing going on with those kids because they're having to learn how to synchronize with a mom who isn't always in touch with them emotionally. And so the modeling of consistency there actually trains the brain. And if I could get into more of it, the main way that the brain learns is by, in infants, is they see what's going on and it's being modeled for them and then their brain syncs with that and absorbs it. So if dysfunction's being modeled in the home, they absorb that, their brain trains and syncs with the dysfunction in the home rather than with the happiness of the joy and the returning to joy that's going on in the home. So modeling is the number way, one way this happens. Another very concrete thing we can do is the validate and comfort. So for example, the boy goes out, falls off his bike, skins his knee. First times that happens, you think you're going to die, right? It's like, I've never felt this kind of pain before. There is blood coming out of my body. I'm going to die, right? And then you go running home. Well, what happens on that response home is supposed to happen is the mom's supposed to validate. Oh, poor baby, that has to really hurt. And then she's supposed to do something to comfort it until he gets to the point where he can go back out and play with joy again. Well, that's supposed to happen. But what happens if he comes home and the mom says, oh, grow up. What is wrong with you anyway? And you get shame instead, or you get, you just don't go through the process. The other thing that happens is if you flip comforting and validation, you have a negative thing that happens. That if somebody comes to you with a hurt knee, you say, oh, just wash it off, you'll be fine. And you go straight to comforting, you actually are invalidating their emotion, and that in itself can be traumatizing to them. So it's very important that we get those things in order. So modeling is number one, and then the validating and comforting process, I'd say, would be number two. And then just being intentional about life skills. Because every time a dad takes his son out to go, do yard work or to go camping or to work on the car, they have an opportunity to bond. And as they're bonding over passing down the skills, more is happening there than just learning that skill. They are also learning self-esteem. They're learning an identity. They're learning all kinds of other things that give them capacity for life. When a mom is bonding with her son or bonding with her daughter, same thing. More is going on there than just the passing on of skills. Their capacity to handle life is growing.
So when you mention praying through this and understanding the trauma, where this begins, are you seeing that as a one-time healing process? And what are your thoughts about using a mentor and a therapist
sure.
to, in essence, reparent?
I think the question was, when I hear you talking about using interactive prayer to go back, and it sounds like a one-time process, and how does that integrate with the idea of having mentoring and an ongoing relationship? And I said they are accomplishing different things. Healing, it's like surgery. You only have to have the surgery once. But physical therapy may go on for a long time. Same thing here. A lot of times these interactive prayers only have to happen the one time depending on whether it's a simple memory or whether they were talking about a lifetime of patterned memories. But if you have a fairly simple, straightforward one, it can happen in one moment, and that is dealt with. But now you partner it with the other, and it becomes like physical therapy after the surgery. Yeah, it's a good question. She said, we talked about joy in a container and being like this, and do we have different containers for different parts of our lives? The answer would be yes, because just like you can have high skill in piano playing and maybe no skill in gardening, okay, you can have high skill in certain areas of relationship and almost no skill in other areas of relationship. And so we call these potholes. I'm going along life, and all of a sudden I fall into this pothole, and I'm not quite sure why. Well, usually that's because I just got triggered in an area where I don't have the skills, and it's a sign to me that either there's B trauma or there's an A trauma thing that needs to be redone. He mentioned reparenting, and reparenting is an excellent way to recover from A trauma. Reparenting is an excellent tool for dealing with A trauma. It often doesn't have that much impact on B trauma. R was for remember. The R-E-A-L is... it's easy to forget. Okay. R is remember, E is explore, A is ask, and L is listen. Yes?
You talked about when your wife comes from your ride,
just
wanted your attention. Yes. You didn't say how that was resolved.
Well, I went to Jeffrey Cohen for therapy, but I started making appointments for myself to try to figure out what was going on underneath, and I found out a whole bunch of what my issues were that I had never put a label on before and never really realized how big of a deal they were. So I started going to a counselor and processing through those things. And what I find is that almost every day you can get triggered. But you can resolve that in that day most of the time if you will take the time to go back and pray this through with God. What just got triggered? What was the wound underneath here that just got triggered? What were the lies that were in that wound? Jesus, would you just come in here and show me whatever it is that you need to do to bring healing for that? And so it can become almost a lifestyle of things, because we all have been wounded in 1,000 different little ways. And we often, and I tell people, it's not the size of the trauma that impacts you, it's the power of the lie that got planted in the trauma. So you might have a tiny little thing here, like you're in kindergarten and everybody's, happy but you. And you look around the classroom, you're going, why am I the only one who doesn't seem happy? And then Satan shows up and whispers in your ear, well, it's because you're a loser and you're a reject. Well, that's not a hugely traumatizing event on the scale of life, but that's a very powerful lie. And if I believe the lie, then it doesn't matter how hugely traumatizing it was. As long as I believe that lie, it will direct my life. And that's what we tell people. Because some people look back and say, I don't have much trauma. I mean, I had a really good life. And they're probably right. They probably did. And on a scale of 1 to 10, it was probably great. But that's not the point, really. The point is, did you get all of the training that you needed for success in the adult world? Did you get, did you have any wounding things back there where false beliefs may have gotten planted? If so, then you got issues to work on. All right, are we done?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you,
Mike. Thank you.
Tell you one thing, we're better together.